The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai. Ireland's fastest growing car brand. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Everyone's talking about the revolution driven by Hyundai. Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Áine Lawler here for Marion. Good morning. Well, you wouldn't have thought, would you, that Kerry and Mayo could repeat the magnificent performance of last weekend, much less go one better. And apart from the messing at the end, it was the most amazing performance from both teams in Limerick last night. I think it's even more remarkable when you remember the fact these are guys with day jobs, you know, they're going to work during the week and then turning up on this. The fitness, the commitment, the passion. Anyhow, obviously the passion got a bit out of control at the end. There are lots of sore Mayo hearts this morning, and but they and Mayo and Kerry have certainly put it up to Dublin and Donegal this afternoon. There's actually a picture of Bernard Brogan on the front of the Sunday Business Post. The booming business of the Dubs. Their main story is that semi-states enjoy pay increases during the recession. Semi-state employer pension contributions have averaged 17%. The average semi state pay €58,000, airport cleaners topping €50,000 per annum. And they're talking about companies like Bordnamona, RTE, Bord Gáis, Dublin Port and Railway Procurement Agency. Also on the Business Post front page, boardroom battle to take centre stage at NTR AGM this week. And a new column from Pat Rabbit in which he's saying, can RTE do anything but doom and gloom? That's on page 16. Inside. The Sunday Independent. Irish UN troops in Al-Qaeda gun battle. Pressure mounts on Simon Coveney after new departure for peacekeepers. We'll be talking to security analyst Declan Power about those really worrying developments there. And also a story about the late Albert Reynolds from Jody Corcoran involving a payment of 500, I think it would be punts, wouldn't it? Yeah, it would be punts that were apparently paid for a private eye file. The Sunday Times. Beverly Finn's partner had €40 million in debt, and also a story that at least 120 babies born in Britain during week 23 of a pregnancy, which is the last week when abortions are legal there, have survived in the past 4 years. Also apparently in the Sunday Times, the ECB is going to be spending billions on bonds. We know that Mario Draghi has been talking up the need for growth in the Eurozone, and everybody of course scratching their heads and wondering what that might mean for all of us here, and what indeed that might mean to the Germans. And also on the Sunday Times front page, blue is the colour in Ireland. The most common eye colour in Ireland is now blue. I'd have thought it was always blue all the time, but anyhow, apparently that's the latest. The Irish Mail on Sunday is out on its own with a souvenir edition, a classic Penn State clinch victory with last gasp field goal. Of course, that was the excitement in Croke Park, but I think couldn't match anything that was happening in Limerick. Simon Cowell, of course, that ratings war over the X Factor. It's on the front of the Daily Star Sunday. He says he'll pull the plug on the X Factor if they don't win the ratings war. Well, the plug might get pulled on him, I would have thought. But anyway, the Irish in Syria free fight is the Irish Sun on Sunday story. And my life inside the mob is in the Sunday World. Let me introduce today's panel to you. I'm delighted to welcome to studio Charlie Byrne, journalist and broadcaster, Anne Ferris, Labour TD, Wicklow and East Carlow, Dermot Ferreter, Professor of Modern Irish History in UCD, Alison O'Connor, Irish Examiner columnist, Jim Power, economist, and Des Cahill from The Sunday Game. And the sport is really the big news, Des, isn't it?
Well, Pat Rabbit would be pleased that the sport is generally good news, but as a Mayo man, and he's a keen Mayo supporter, he'd be devastated by last night. But you made the point there about amateurs. The fact that there was a big fuss about the match not being in Croke Park because of the American football. But I think on a closer level to the fellas who were playing, people forgot there was only a 6 day turnaround, because last week was a huge physical battle as well. And the difference between these guys, you said they have day jobs. Say the Leinster rugby players, the soccer players, what's built into their day is rest. That's a key part of, you know, you might do a weight session, rest, video, but rest is a key part of it. And obviously those guys, some are students or whatever, but working guys, and that's a huge difference. But yesterday, the physical intensity of it and the emotional pressure that comes with it, and the atmosphere that was there. It was as intense as I've seen.
It was actually a pity anyone had to win, wasn't it?
I was kind of hoping that Mayo would get that equaliser, you know, when they had to get a goal. But then I was thinking, well, Croke Park, if we get back to that debate, we're going to get messy.
Just sorry to cut across you. Someone has a mobile phone on. It's just creating a bit of buzz, if you wouldn't mind just checking that all the phones have been. Were you all watching? Were you watching, Dermot?
Well, it was another extraordinary encounter, and the level of fitness of the players in this year is just phenomenal. You mentioned the encounter they had just 6 days ago, and then you see that. But not only that, it goes into extra time, and you can still see their fitness on display. And Des, you're absolutely right about the emotion that was swirling around and a lot of aggression. Arna, you used a lovely GAA euphemism about the messing at the end. But it was a bit more than that now. And at one stage, I felt very sorry for the referee, but then I felt, right, does he actually have control of this game? And a few of the recent games have raised interesting questions about refereeing and the dilemmas of the referees. And for a game like that, where there's so much at stake, and even more so for Mayo, of course, the long wait, and now it continues, but 1951. And for the Kerry team, it's a very interesting time because there was that great Kerry team. Kerry were going through a kind of a transitional phase.
And nobody expected it
of
this team.
No, this team is looking very interesting.
Alison. I mean, I was actually out and following it on Twitter and thrilled to get home for the extra time. And it was quite amazing. And your heart had to go out to Mayo. And yet you marvelled at Kerry, who people felt were not at the peak of their cycle in terms of a new... So it was incredible. But I found what happened at the end quite incredible too. I mean, it was an all-out melee. There's no two ways about it, and it could have got far worse very easily. And even to hear the commentator say what can the ref do? I mean, who would he book now? And so there was this expectation.
And if he did book, wouldn't they get off during the week anyway?
Yeah, that nothing could be done. So, I mean, and then to watch the 9 o'clock news, the television news, and there was absolutely no mention whatsoever of this messing,
maybe it's to do with Pat Rabbit.
My final point is this man who we all saw attempting to run onto the pitch, I think a Mayo supporter who I think it took six people to
check.
If you check Twitter, you'll see that man in Supermax after smiling broadly and being people queuing up to have their photograph taken.
That was my bigger issue. I can't understand why he wasn't trying to keep away from the publicity given what he had been involved in. But
it's regarded as messing, because it's regarded as part of what the game is.
No, that isn't. The man coming in from the crowd isn't.
Yeah, I have to say, I thought the whole thing was wrong from the word go. I mean, the 6 day turnaround, I thought was mad. I had occasion last Wednesday to drive from Mulrani to Limerick, and it's a nightmare of a drive. I can only imagine what it was like for the Mayo supporters with all the traffic coming
down. I'd say they didn't mind going back.
Well,
I'd say their hearts were broken.
I mean, I thought the refereeing performance was totally inept. I thought he virtually handed it to Kerry on a plate.
Harsh.
I know in the first half of extra time, he gave two frees to Mayo.
But GAA refs have a tough time.
Were not.
Yeah, that's
and the second penalty for Kerry was not a penalty.
Well, I would have given
the penalty.
Yeah, I think he'll get 5 years freeholders in Kerry after that. Deserves it.
You know, in fairness, was it Alison made the point? It's so difficult to referee now. And supposing he had sent off guys early on. Now, the black card, the GA appeared. The black card is where you get, if you pull or drag a fella down on purpose, pull him to the ground or trip him on purpose, you have to go off. But a sub can come on, but you can't participate. Mm-hmm. So that's meant to be a deterrent. That is not being implemented.
They were bottling it last night.
Yeah, there could have been 8 or 10.
Occasions.
But not in fairness to that referee, not he alone. And I think what was in his head was, and I can understand why, I don't want to send off, we just mentioned they're amateurs, I don't want to send them off, I don't want to send him off. But if you don't show someone's going to go off, then they'll keep doing it.
Can it work like jury service for a referee? You know, if you catch a referee again like that, but you don't have to do it for 10 years.
And what about today? You're going today, are you, Jim?
I'm going today, absolutely. I was at the Donegal-Monaghan game, and Dublin were playing... Sorry, Donegal and Armagh, I beg your pardon. Dublin were playing Monaghan after it. Yeah. And when Donegal won, I turned around to a Donegal guy behind me and said, "Do you really call that football?"
Ooh.
It, it, It was dreadful, the style.
Oh,
so I really hope this afternoon style wins out and that the Dubs blow them apart.
You bring but your own you, security you guard, Jim.
Is there any team that's capable of getting past Dublin? I mean, that question has been asked a lot. But then, have they been really, truly tested?
They'll get tested today.
They certainly would, you would think.
I go with my daughter, who wears a Donegal shirt. Passionately, she's mad Donegal supporter, but and I'm going, with Mammy, but I'm going with Tomás O'Shea as well, one of the Kerry O'Shea brothers. And yesterday, as far as I know, I've asked Tomás, Mark O'Shea didn't start, he came on as a sub and was inspired.
Yeah.
But I think it was the first time Kerry played without one of the O'Shea brothers since 1993, which is an incredible
Yeah.
And he came on, I'd say they dropped him on purpose. He was taken when he came on, if you know what I mean. He came on very, he was ready to do damage, and he did. He was brilliant.
Despite the reservations I expressed earlier, I think you'd have to take your hat off to somebody like James. I don't know who.
Yeah. You have to take your hat off to James Moran as well. You know, when you look at what he has done with the Mayo team since 2000, or James Moran since 2011, and he's going now, and there's a big question there for Mayo.
Yeah, that's the really cruel part of sport, because it was a fantastic performance. They might have got the result they want, but it was a fantastic performance.
To say one last thing about Donegal, and you'd understand this, for a smaller county and smaller population, and given that Donegal has massive emigration, I've so many nephews and nieces away, Jim McGuinness has a tiny pick. Yeah. Of players, and Dublin have a massive pick. And for Jim McGuinness to achieve and get them as far as he does it the only way they can do it. And so he deserves, Donegal should not be criticised for the way they play if that's with a small
that's
group.
That's a fair
the only
point,
way
Charlie.
Make sure you're well in the
home. Last night's match, I was hanging my head because Manchester United drew once again. But there is one point about it. All the money that Manchester United spend on players, and then you have these fantastic players who play in the GAA amateur sport, and what they serve up is absolutely fantastic. You know, and you have to sometimes put a little bit of perspective in it. It's absolutely fantastic.
Well, with the money they got from Croke Park yesterday, it has been done as a precedent before, where there was extra money brought in on a replay. Give them both a holiday out of, you know.
Yeah,
here, here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well deserved.
I didn't see it on you, but just in relation to what you call the messing there, I don't know whether anybody has seen the ad for the minor football thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it shows the guys and eating their dinners and studying and whatever they're doing. But when they're on the pitch, you will notice that they look at each other, they're eyeballing each other and kind of almost shouldering each other. So, you know, it is, I don't know, is it being taken for granted that this messing goes on? You know, is it being learned at a very early stage?
I remember one time, it was hurling, I think, in that case, my son had broken a thumb and he had one of those cast things on it and I was doing he had to play a match, whatever, and I was doing the, oh my God, keep that safe and all the rest, and he insisted on taking the cast off. It was one of these removable ones because he said if anybody saw it, they'd go to whack that thumb deliberately.
Yeah. Like,
so,
I mean,
it's
argue,
a tough game.
You could, somebody coming in unfamiliar with GAA and unfamiliar with this culture that has built up, as we were saying earlier, of expecting that this will happen, could have looked at that last night and thought, why has the referee not just stopped this? That there was a valid... There
you
was
mean
a
abandon
very,
the match?
Abandon the match. There could have been a very valid...
It's a perfectly reasonable point on one level. The guards would come in and say, are you mad? We'll have chaos. You know? It's wrong. It's totally wrong.
It's interesting.
Totally.
At the Armagh Donegal game, there was a lot of unsavoury stuff going on the pitch. And
Hold on.
Yeah. But there was. And yet you see up on the screen, give respect, show respect. Yeah. This is the GAA mantra.
But the other thing you see, Jim, when you're at big matches like that, which the GAA are very careful to do, you're at a bit of the stadium where you can't quite see the melee at the other end, and they make sure to take it off the screen.
Yeah,
I mean, it's real Soviet stuff that they blank it.
The point
is
made about, you know, whatever about the players and the referee, you know, other people coming onto the pitch, you know, that could get very, very serious. And there was a very controversial incident a couple of weeks ago, which you've talked about in relation to someone being pushed over. You know, so, you know, when it becomes...
There was a Mayo mentor on the pitch last night. And you ask yourself the question, what the hell was he doing there? Yeah. As was the case in the...
I'm not here to defend you, but you're right about that. But just in relation to going off the screen, which is hugely frustrating, even some account of what should it have been sending off or not, and people have paid in. Colm O'Rourke argues, if you pay in, you should be allowed to see it.
As much as people see at home, indeed.
Yes, but the argument against it is that if the referee has made an error, or if... supposing the referee has sent somebody off from your team and he's wrong, the crowd go berserk. It creates tension in the crowd fight, and that is the
I know a guy who's responsibility for replaying the bits. He's behind the screen.
No, be careful. We don't know.
They are in strict instructions not to replay incentives.
But even going way back,
there's a kind of a prav. There's an element of prav to
event.
I'm getting texts. Who is that woman saying that?
There's wonderful archival footage of Micheál O'Hare. You know the original radio broadcast and radio commentary, even before Micheál O'Hare Hurtig. That's how far back you're going. And he used to say this if there was a melee going on. I don't for the life of me know what all the booing is about. You know, and everybody listening knew that there was some kind of a scrap going on. So it's nothing new in that sense.
It comes down to local, and it comes down to, this is why people get more intense. Say Manchester United, that Charlie mentioned, Louis van Gaal, he buys Angel de Maria.
He's Van Gaal, isn't he?
Gary Lineker said Van Gaal. BBC have a big pronunciation effort, but I think it's actually a bit of a call, but anyway.
Bit of fun there, Charlie. Yeah.
The point I'm making
Where is he from in Ireland?
the money that's spent there, and you compare it. Today, I'm involved with a team in Coola, and one of our lads is playing off the team I'm with every Sunday. That's huge for us.
Yeah.
We were out this morning at 9 o'clock, or half nine, so that everyone could be in there in time. And the captain of the minor team, Con O'Callaghan, is from our club, and his brothers play, and his mother and his dad's manager won the teams. That's huge. So you go along, it's very different going along, because it gives you a whole more intense feeling about the match than some.
And there's a just one thing before we leave this, actually. Absolutely. There was a comment from Joe Brawley, and actually, I don't know what Enda Kenny would make of this. He's saying Mayo will never have the ruthlessness you need to be champions. That's a bit harsh, isn't it?
Oh, that's rubbish.
That's total.
Classic Joe Brawley, isn't it?
I would like to say my kids play GAA every Saturday morning, and I think it's fabulous. And that's the very reason why, they weren't in the room last night for that. But I mean, if they were, it would have been, what's going on there? You know, how do you explain that sort of a melee to kids,
so, and
that's part of
it.
Luckily, I didn't have to, Charlie. If you have any advice on that front, I do.
I don't know how Brawley could say that, though, particularly the match last week, the second half, and what Mayo did then. Yeah. I mean, the kind of character and passion that was there, and the skills.
Yeah, they're amazing, absolutely. And as a
Look, people will be talking about all of this into the wee small hours, but there is another group of Irish heroes, but they're certainly facing an awful lot of pressure at the moment, and the situation for our. Our troops in Syria is extremely concerning at the moment. Charlie, what do you make of developments there?
They're doing the job.
What are the options, do you think, for Simon Coveney and the Irish government?
Well,
now?
I think they should stay there. I mean, they've always known that part of Lebanon. I think it goes back to 1979, their mandate there. So when things get rough, and I think the Irish troops, any place I've ever gone in Liberia or to Chad, when they've been on the ground, they've been absolutely fantastic. So I think they're up to the job. And, you know, when a bit of heat comes on them, it's not a question of we must pull them out. We must. We shouldn't be the only ones. If Filipino soldiers are in there, if Fijian troops are in there on the ground, and in other cases Nigerian soldiers are in the ground wearing what they call the blue helmet, well, then it is important that we stick, that we all stick to these jobs. I mean, they are there with a mandate and a peacekeeping mandate. I think it's crucially important that they stay there.
The interesting thing, again, looking at this historically, I mean, there's over 50 years of involvement now, Irish troops with the UN. You go right back, obviously, to what was going on in Katanga and the Belgian Congo and places like that. And one of the dilemmas has always been in relation to peacekeeping forces. What do you do when it moves from peacekeeping to these soldiers being caught up in a civil war? As did happen back in the early 1960s.
In a civil war and a disputed border.
And it creates a real difficulty for the government at home, because what an Irish government has done right from the late 50s into the early 1960s to expand its foreign involvement is to say, OK, we're committing troops, but they are UN troops. You know, they're not our troops now once they're out there under that mandate. But then pressure is created when things go wrong. And that's why there's pressure now on Coveney to respond to this. And we know now from behind the scenes what was going on way back in the early 1960s, where, you know, the Minister for Defence is saying, you know, what can I actually do about this? Because public opinion is now beginning to question the mandate and question the sacrifice. And of course, ultimately what happened out there was that people died, Irish troops died. And it becomes an issue that they can't contain in the same way, because they can't say, well, they're on a peacekeeping mission. Is it still a peacekeeping mission? And, you know, does an Irish government have to respond?
But the first time a bullet is fired, you can't, or there's a bit of tension, you can't say, oh my God, we better start considering this and moving them out.
Put on your headphones, because we've security analyst Declan Power on the line. And Declan, you certainly know the area pretty well. And the fact that Irish troops were involved in this mission to help rescue their colleagues who were... surrounded by Al-Qaeda type forces, not ISIS, but definitely Al-Qaeda, we're told. Is it still peacekeeping? How dangerous is this situation?
Well, let's cut to the chase. It's extremely dangerous. It's an extremely dangerous mission in how it's evolved. But I suppose to clarify a few things, it's the first in recent times of the more classical types of peacekeeping missions that Ireland has been involved in, because peacekeeping evolved, especially since the end of the Cold War, and people may be familiar with terms such as Chapter 6 or Chapter 7 missions. This is a Chapter 6 mission. Most of the missions Irish troops have been on in recent years have been Chapter 7 or Chapter 8, meaning peace enforcement. What does that mean, simply? It means that the planning and the configuration of Chapter 7 and Chapter 8 peace enforcement missions are much harder-edged. More troops, heavier armed, and they have the right to engage in offensive action. They don't have to wait to be attacked if they feel that they are going to establish a more peaceful environment. They have that mandate, whereas the mandate in the Golan Heights is one that was originally an observer mission set up in 1974 to create a buffer zone between the Syrian military forces and Israeli military forces. And that, you know, has changed considerably. The Irish contingent are out there as a quick reaction force, a type of military fire brigade. Our troops have both the equipment and the training in a way that some of the other nations on that mission wouldn't have, to be able to give harder-edged support. But nevertheless, we shouldn't be under any illusions. Mm-hmm. It's escalated kind of way beyond the nature of the mandate and the nature of the configuration of that force.
And then I suppose the question for Simon Coveney and the government here, the question for the Irish people is, what can a military fire brigade achieve when you've got a civil war going on a disputed border and the certainties of the Cold War are long past us?
Well, that's true. I think there's two ways of looking at this. It's important that people be aware of this. From a strategic point of view, there's a worthwhile debate that maybe needs to be had when things are tamped down a little bit, when some in the next weeks or months, as to the efficacy of having the UNDOF force there. That's a decision that needs to be looked at within the UN, and discussed within the UN. It's not a time for countries to start engaging in unilateral action and talking about withdrawing troops or that. The reason the Irish troops are there primarily is because some nations withdrew their troops and they needed people to shore it up. From a tactical point of view, the troops on the ground, the Irish contingent have made a massive difference. I mean, you only have to look at the international reportage. I had two leading Israeli newspapers, a former colleague of mine drew my attention to this morning. The Jerusalem Post and the Israeli News are both lauding the successful operation to rescue, to get out beleaguered Filipino peacekeepers, who, all credit to the Filipinos, they held their ground. They refused to be intimidated into being disarmed, even though they were surrounded by superior forces. The members of the Irish Quick Reaction Force managed to secure routes for their Filipino colleagues to escape out of and to a more reinforced area. And this would have been from around the area of Checkpoint 69, further south in the zone of separation, around an area called Buraqua. And they have been removed now further up into the... I'm not 100% sure, because the Defence mm-hmm. Forces are saying absolutely very little about this for reasons of operational security. But a lot of Filipino soldiers, peacekeepers, have been got out of the beleaguered area around Checkpoint 69 down in the south. Now, that's been a very successful operation so far, considering the high levels of threat and volatility. And we should be aware of that. That's not just about the planning and the training that went into place earlier and the pre-deployment mm-hmm. training, but also the additional specialists that Ireland has sent out there, specialist engineering search teams, counter IED teams who detect and deal with roadside bombs. And it's that pre-planning and pre-deployment training that has allowed the freedom of movement of the Irish and their other UN colleagues to be successful and to help de-escalate. Because if those guys aren't surrounded, that will help de-escalate the situation for those that are surrounded and hopefully having a peaceful resolution to this situation.
I think everyone's hoping for a peaceful resolution to a lot of situations in the Middle East at the moment, but we can only hope that things, certainly in the area where our troops are stationed with that UN mission, that things settle down soon. Declan Power, thanks very much indeed for that update, and thanks also to Des, who's gone off to bring his Donegal and Dublin heart to that match this afternoon. The big story, I suppose, of the week, and as I say, the papers, you know, there's a big choice of headlines, but one of the big stories that was running in various shapes and sizes this week was housing, whether it's the difficulty for students getting housing and the implications there. And of course, we saw that eviction of Martin and Violet Coyne, just highlighting, you know, the pressure that families are under. And despite the pickup in the economy, this hasn't gone away. It's one thing, Anne Ferris, I suppose, we get politicians, you know, promising and promising. But the fact of the matter, there aren't fast solutions here, are there?
There aren't. This is not a short term. There's no short term solution to the problem at the moment. I know Minister Jan O'Sullivan before she became Education Minister, she was working on a programme as to how to deal with the problem. And it's not just, say, housing for students, although that has hit the headline in the papers today, which is it's a crisis for students if they can't find accommodation. But I certainly know it, even in my own constituency in Wicklow, the amount of people that are on social housing lists. So there's a shortage of council housing, there's a shortage of housing, affordable housing for people, young couples to buy, and there's also a shortage of houses to rent, because a lot, which is pushing the price to rent up, and you know, it's a terrible situation which has to be dealt with, but I don't think there is a short term solution. I know that the department is putting money into are letting, say, some NAMA houses go, putting money into, because there's a lot of houses around the countryside, social housing, boarded up because the councils hadn't had the money to do the refurbishment. So there's been money being put into that to be able to release it to people who are on council's list. But people, I think, who had second properties, who had those houses out for rent, because of things like the NPPR charge, which is now overtaken by the property charge, and various other reasons, they're trying to sell these houses. So that would bring some houses back on the market, but at the same time, those houses will no longer be available for rent.
Yeah, because at the same time during the week, Jim Parr, didn't we have that story, wasn't the Irish Times yesterday, about this black economy of professionals who were, after revenue audits, it turns out that an awful lot of them were getting undeclared rental income. So one way or another, whatever way you look at it, the whole housing situation seems to be a mess. And there are those who argue that if you want supply improved, it's about government basically getting rid of a lot of the red tape that slows up building.
I would agree with Anne's point there that there is no short-term solution. But where I would fundamentally disagree is that this isn't a problem that has suddenly arisen now. It's a problem that's been building for a long, long time and nothing has been done about it. There are many aspects to it. Obviously, we haven't built a house in Dublin for 6 or 7 years virtually. Okay, so, and there's a lot of pent-up demand coming through now. But I think a more fundamental issue is that we don't have a professional rental market in this country. We saw from that couple during the week in West Dublin, they had no rights whatsoever. We have a whole load of amateur landlords.
But there seems to be a political reluctance to go near the area of sorting out the rental
We need to create a professional rental market.
Why? Because it means impinging on private property rights.
Yes, absolutely. But if you look at a rental market like Germany, for example, it's heavily regulated on both sides. The tenants have rights.
And also house prices are related to average earnings.
They are indeed.
I mean, whether you are rich or poor, whether you want to rent or buy, whether you're a student, whether you're people who've lived like this couple for 15 years in your house, even if you have money and you want to buy a house, the whole, every aspect of the market, it strikes me, is messed up. And it's quite, it was understandable when the government first came into office that they maybe didn't want to look at the, it was a real kind of verboten no-go area. But that for this amount of time to have pushed on and for more not to have been done is actually a major, major political failure. And we have, understandably, the new minister, Alan Kelly, the Minister for the Environment, has been on holidays. But I find it quite extraordinary, actually, that we haven't heard more from him, even in the last week. If you even look at how, for instance, Leo Varadkar has handled his new brief and kept the profile.
He could perhaps say a lot, but what could he do?
Well, I mean, considering how little has been done, I think he could show. I mean, there are things, Anne mentioned even these houses that have been boarded up. I find this incredible, what are called voids, these social authority houses. It's extraordinary the amount of them that are around the country. And when people are being, on one hand, one arm of the state is putting people up in guest houses and looking at doing kind of what strikes me as stupid things like old Garda stations and that, thinking they'll put people in there. And that you have perfectly good housing that needs a little bit of work boarded up around the country. It really, I mean, it sounds cliched to say it, but boy, does it need joined up thinking.
And the real implications of these are very, very serious. I mean, the social housing waiting list is a total calamity with massive social implications. But if you look at the Higher Education Authority, admitted, at least it's quoted in the Sunday Business Post, the Irish Sunday Independent today, that for the first time ever, they are now seeing students being forced to put off going to college because they cannot get accommodation. The sort of economic
are travelling huge distances.
And people making college choices depending on the cost of accommodation.
That's all wrong.
It's hugely expensive. And don't forget, there are people who do very well out of a housing crisis and have always done well out of housing crises. They reckon there's 16,000 students getting ready to enrol on first year courses. That's a huge amount of students. That's one aspect of the crisis. We've seen another aspect in relation to people being evicted from their houses that they are renting. And then we have people who are homeless on the streets who have no homes at all, rented or otherwise. And one of the things that Anne said there worried me in the sense that, you know, Jan O'Sullivan was working on this, but then she's promoted to Minister for Education. What does that mean for the plan? Is there a continuity in relation to that? Is there some kind of vision there that is a priority? Or is this going to fall victim to politics and fall between different stools and different departments?
I don't think it will, Dermot, because when Alan Kelly was appointed Minister for the Environment, he said that he was going to take housing as is, you know, as a priority into his department. Now,
well,
I know
we hear those kind of phrases from politicians a lot of the time. I think what people want to see is, you know, something that's going to have an effect. One of the big worries, I think, for an awful lot of people as well, is simply, you know, the cranes are back, the for sale signs are back, the prices are rocketing again. And if you get the, you know, once you start getting that kind of bubble going on, you're going to have a distortion. You're not going to have an equitable or efficient property market, and we're going to have these problems. But on the other hand, all of that bubble is very good for the banks. It's very good for now. So on one level, you know,
and you
maybe,
want the government, you want the government to come up with a housing policy, not just a construction policy, a housing policy that addresses all those issues, that you're living in an apartment, for instance, that you're not, you know, staring at your knickers drying as you're washing the telly, as so many people have in Dublin and other cities because of the sizes of apartments, or you have somewhere to put your rubbish or things like that. You're never going to, or where houses can be, planning permission, rental rights, all those kind of things, that it has to be an across-the-board policy rather than, you mentioned there, the cranes and construction. Most Irish people, I think, would tell you now that they would be suspicious that this whole thing is going to go down a wrong road again and that nothing has changed.
Charlie. In the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, there was a housing problem. It's been with us all the time and like the poor. If you had Father Peter McVeary sitting in this studio now, other people, he'd be saying the same thing. My God, he'd be pulling his hair out. Yeah. We've had this, and you make the point, it's easy for, we're going to have a new plan. A new government comes in, we're going to have a new plan. And that's
there's
all
always
very
a housing
well.
Plan, isn't
but
there?
Always, you mentioned the 70s there. I mean, if you even go back to something like the Kenny Report in the middle of the 1970s, land. Which is really, it's not just about land, it's also about, is a government prepared to much more aggressively intervene in the housing question?
Yes.
And the dilemma was always, we can't interfere with the sacrosanct private property, you know.
Do you agree with that?
Well,
Anne?
I think there could be that fear there, and indeed,
Especially in Fine Gael, maybe.
Perhaps I'm not going to say one way or the other, but I think also we
Our
have
hands
to
are
look.
Trembling.
We have to look at the structures. Dermot, you said there earlier about 16,000 first-year college students. they could not seek accommodation until they got their CAO offer.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's only in the last few weeks. So they've had to wait for now to start looking for accommodation. That, in my view, is too late. So perhaps, you know, the whole structure's education perhaps will have to be changed to allow, you know, to allow for this.
Well, that would cause another kind
but
of...
But it's also known in any given year there is going to be that massive...
But it was gas, not gas, but they're, really they're, bizarre the other day.
Students.
I was coming down the quays and, you know, you'd everyone going off with their backpacks and their tents off to the electric picnic. I'll tell you, the past couple of nights, I am glad I was not in a tent. But anyway, and then beside them on the custom house steps, there were people who had no tent overnight, just sleeping bags. And you're looking at them and thinking, you know, they'd no choice, and the numbers appear to be increasing. So that's where we leave that one. And actually, we're going to talk about something we were talking about yesterday, which is the whole ALS, motor neuron disease, all of that. We're going to talk about the research that it's all for and why where the research in motor neuron disease is going. We'll be joined by Professor Orla Hardiman after this break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Everyone's talking about the revolution driven by Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Welcome back. Now, we've been joined by Professor Orla Hardiman, and this follows the call we had yesterday with the Freighties, which was about the phenomenon of the summer. Here it is.
Right, this is my ice cream.
Oh, mammy! Jesus, mammy!
Here we go. Whew, that's brisk.
So that was various people taking ice bucket challenges, which seems to have been the phenomenon of the summer. And we were talking to the Freighties yesterday about how it all went viral after their son, who has what the Americans call ALS, we call motor neuron disease. And after he challenged his former teammates in Boston College, and it kind of took off from there. And there's been loads of people saying, you know, it's a bit of a self-congratulatory campaign. And, you know, all the kids have been out doing it and half the time not even knowing what they're doing it for. So what's the point of all of this? And Professor Orla Hardiman, you do know more than most what the point of all of this is, because it's your job.
Yes, it is my job. And I think the first thing to say was we're really, really grateful for the amount of interest that people have had in this campaign. And you're right that there has been a bit of a disconnect between, you know, the campaign and really what it's about. But it is about something very serious. It is about this horrible disease, motor neuron disease, or ALS, that affects about 110 people in Ireland every year. It's about 300 people in Ireland living with it every year. And the campaign, as you rightly pointed out, started in the United States based on a challenge by a young man of 27 who developed ALS and motor neuron disease, and who challenged people to develop awareness and also to support the fight, to challenge people to support the fight against ALS or motor neuron disease. And that came over here then, I think probably at the beginning of August, and the Irish Motor Neuron Disease Association under the CEO of Aisling Farrell and the chairmanship of Declan McDade took on that challenge, and it just took off from there in this country as well. But really it is about something very serious. It's about trying to make a world free of motor neuron disease, and that would be a great thing if we could do that.
What Nancy Freighties said yesterday, and it was really telling, I thought, was, you know, there's the awful moment when they got the diagnosis from the doctor, you know, this is what it is. Then there was the even worse moment when the doctor said, I'm very sorry, we've no cure, there's nothing we can do.
Actually, I got a text yesterday from Anne Murray, who said to me, the ice bucket challenge is actually a very good way of describing what happens when you hear the diagnosis. It's like being having a bucket of ice poured over you. I thought actually that's very apt, in fact.
Yeah. And Charlie, of course, you know, we saw Colin.
Yeah, Orla, I mean, it's just for me, it brings back all, you know, just awful memories, because we used to go out and see him and his wife. But you're right, something has to be done about it. But could I ask the question? Money is put into all sorts of charities. Is it not, in a sense, taking away from a government responsibility or a wider sense of responsibility from a whole community, that it shouldn't always be throwing money into a bucket to do something? I know that's good and that engenders an interest and people they want to get up off their backside to do something. But in a way, sometimes I feel it's leaving, if you like, the whole political class
off the hook?
Well, I think that there are 2 points to that. Well, I suppose almost even 3 points. The first point is actually that, you know, the money that was raised for the IMNDA and the research that we do will benefit from that as well, came in denominations of €2, you know. And it is somewhat ironic that it's the same organisation, along with others, including the Neurological Alliance and other neurological organisations, that had the funding cut by Pubble earlier in the summer. Mm-hmm. So that is somewhat ironic that in €2 and €3 denominations, we were able to, you know, but by various orders of magnitude, increase the funding for this for you know, a very important charity. But you're right that you know, I suppose how we look after people with neurologic disabilities in Ireland is shocking, because we do rely very heavily on the voluntary sector for that, and it is something, you know, the fact that the Pubble felt it would be okay to cut the funding for these organisations, and then the debate about, well, should the organisations be funding these sorts of activities anyway? You know, shouldn't the government be funding it? It's okay for voluntary organisations to fund, you know, to fund disability, to fund various different types of conditions, if they're properly governed, and these organisations are, certainly the IMNDA is. There's nothing wrong with that, as long as the funding is secure. And, you know, it doesn't matter how you channel the funding. If the funding is coming from the government and is channeled mm-hmm. to the public sector, to the voluntary organisations, that's fine. But you're right, it should be on a stable footing.
And what's the money you going to be used for?
The money from the IMNDA, I had a conversation, I've been in conversation pretty much during the week, every day, with both Aisling Farrell and Declan McDade from the association. And, I mean, this is a windfall that nobody had expected. So from the voluntary sector perspective, they're going to have to look at this. And one of the things that they're thinking about is looking at, you know, the needs and making sure that the needs are catered for. The last thing they should do, in my opinion, would be to, you know, put money into personnel, because obviously that has to be sustainable. So, you know, the IMNDA is one of the only organisations, for example, that provides equipment for people. And, you know, this equipment really
again,
should be.
Pete Frates was making this point in his blog while he could still talk, because obviously, you know, anyone who's got the disease is desperate for a cure. But, you know, that may be a bit down the road, and I'll talk to you about that in a sec. But what is needed is technology, because technology can make the progression of the disease easier
exactly,
to live with.
Yeah, and the technology obviously is expensive. Now, we work very closely with the CRC, the Central Media Clinic, which got very bad press earlier in the year. CRC is brilliant at operational level, and they provide a lot of technology for activities of daily living, things like voice activated technologies or eye gazes as well. They do all of that training, and the IMNDA funds that. So those sort of technologies are very expensive, and the HSE doesn't fund those. Mm-hmm. The IMNDA funds chairlifts for people as well. They fund high quality electric wheelchairs. So those things are really expensive, and the attrition rate in that sort of equipment is very high. So putting in, you know, really expensive equipment is very important. The HSE is not able to do that. I think 70% of the IMNDA's funding is through donations. They only get about 30% of their operational costs from grants from the government. Mm-hmm. So you know, looking at improving the technology, advancing the technologies, that's something that they're going to look at. And I think they're going to look at the needs of patients, probably working with professionals in doing some kinds of need assessment to make sure that the sorts of services that they're providing are what people want and what people need.
Where's the research at?
Well, the research is actually moving apace, and that is really important. Now, in Ireland, you know, we have a big research programme in Ireland, and we're very linked in at European and worldwide level. I'm actually the editor of the International Journal on ALS and motor neuron disease.
And you were involved in the discovery of a gene that may
be involved in motor neuron disease. We found a gene in 2006, I'm getting old. one of my students at the time, Matt Greenaway, found a gene that seems to be important in motor neuron disease. And one of my previous fellows was involved in the identification of a really important gene, a man called Brian Traynor, who's now in the NIH. But I trained him, and he and others found a very important gene as well. So motor neuron disease has a genetic component to it, and Ireland is a good place to do genetic studies along with colleagues across the world. So we have a big genetic program. If we understand the genetics and the gene environment interaction, that'll help us to identify the pathways, and that in turn will help us to identify new drugs.
But there's no magic wand coming around.
Well, you know, it's a little bit like cancer. You know, cancer used to be a disease, and we used to talk about the cure for cancer. But, you know, there's no cure for cancer. There are treatments for various types of cancer, and the neurodegeneration, of which motor neuron disease is one of many, are very complicated. And actually, motor neuron disease should be more correctly called than motor neuron diseases. And it's not just a motor neuron disease. It involves other parts of the nervous system as well. About 50% of people with motor neuron disease develop some thinking trouble. Actually, we're world leaders in that part, the neuropsychology of what happens in motor neuron disease, and looking at that and understanding it is something that we're very good at in Ireland. And we've done the first and the biggest longitudinal study following people with motor neuron disease and looking what happens to them. And that's because we have a big register of motor neuron disease.
I know Colin was involved in that research, in promoting research. And of course, it's a cause that's very close to a lot of politicians' hearts, of course, with Nicky McFadden. And I think people are at last starting to pay it some kind of attention to what was previously a very neglected condition.
It is. And we all felt very sad when Nicky passed away, but it brought it home. It brings it into almost your own sitting room when you know somebody. And indeed, we were talking earlier about Colin Murray, but it is terrible. And I know, Charlie, you said about the government funding, but it's a little bit like what we were talking about earlier about the housing crisis. I mean, you know, there is very, very little money to go around everywhere where it's needed by the government. And I mean, it wouldn't be that anybody in there's choice to cut funding for services like this. But the Ice Bucket Challenge has been fantastic.
Have any of you taken it?
I have.
Yes. You did it last week.
Yeah.
I still haven't taken it.
Anya, can I say I nominated my parliamentary colleagues in Wicklow to also take the challenge. I've no proof yet that they have done so.
I sent 60 emails to politicians on Wednesday and Thursday, and we had 12 brave souls who come into Trinity, to Front Square in Trinity, and I think there's quite a lot of footage in RT about this. We're very grateful to them, by the way.
Politicians, you know, they don't have the money, but I mean, I know it's going back a number of years. We spent 50 million on a computerised electronic system for voting.
That's when there was money, and it was unwisely spent. But I'm talking about currently, imagine what
50 million could have done to help with motor neurons. I'm just giving one example of what could be done. I'm talking about the political class, all of us.
But Charlie, are you guilty there of what Matt Rabbit is giving out about, which is asking negative questions?
Yes.
Well, to be fair, just to make it positive, actually, I mean, I've been in practice as a neurologist for 18 years, and I lived through the boom. I actually emigrated in the last recession in the 1980s, came back, lived through the boom, and we're in my second recession now. But even during the boom, the funding for these sorts of services was never available. Yeah. Right through the boom, we were fighting for services. We were fighting to put in people on the ground, to put in the right levels of care in the right place to the right people at the right time. And even during the boom, it was always an uphill battle. There were never enough people on the ground. You know, looking after people with chronic disability and neurologic disability is obviously my interest, is an expensive gig. It's not cheap. And really, you know, I think Charlie's right in that we have to really look at how we do this. You know, it's very easy to throw money at trolley crises and to throw money at things that make the headlines. And it's much harder to take a longer view and say, you know, the definition of a just society is to make sure that we look after the people who are least well catered for.
There's a story this morning in the I think it's the Business Post, and they're saying that the agency bill for hospitals this year, it looks like it's going to make 250 million, and it's a story by Susan Mitchell, and that it's going to be 110 million to the end of June, and that's basically almost a doubling of last year. I mean, that is incredible.
Well, that's the employment embargo.
It's the nonsense of one part of the state having an employment embargo and the other paying. And also the Mail on Sunday has the story that because of the limit on people getting gastric bands, there's going to be 40 patients sent to the UK at an extra cost of 760,000.
Well, that's a story. That's obviously going to come back. And Leo Varadkar is saying that there's going to be the mother of all battles over his health budget.
It's also about visibility and volubility, though, isn't it? When you consider particular groups who can, you know, press their claims and make themselves very visible. There was an awful lot of concern in recent years about carers in our society and carers' allowances being cut, and uproar about that. But somebody was making the point that trying to mobilise a particular group who are already carrying such a burden is very, very difficult.
But listen to me, before we come up to midday, because Anne Ferris, I know you'll be leaving us soon, and I want to talk to you about a speech that you made in the Dáil back in July.
That's right.
And I'd say it was probably one of the most personal and heartfelt speeches that's been made in Dáil Éireann in a long time. You were talking, it was the height of the mother and baby crisis, so it's a story that's been running this summer. And you were talking about meeting your long-lost sister after you'd both been adopted out of mother and baby homes.
That's right. And thanks, Áine. Yes, it was actually the last day of the Dáil sitting, and the Commission of Inquiry into the mother and baby homes was being debated. And I felt, and I still feel very strongly, that it should not be just into the mother and baby homes like Tuam, like Bessborough, that the investigation should be into the Magdalene laundries, into the county homes, into every institution where a woman went and had a baby or where mothers and babies were sent. Because certainly there is evidence out there to say that if an unfortunate woman got pregnant, she was sent to a mother and baby home. If she got pregnant a second time, she was actually sent to a Magdalene laundry as a punishment. There's a huge amount written on this, and I've been researching this for a long time. I suppose earlier in the year, I introduced my own open adoption bill, which is going through the Dáil process. But part of the speech, apart from the Commission of Investigation, I was imparting to the minister my own story, because there are so many thousands of people in the country who are in the same situation as I am, but don't have that voice and they're not being listened to.
Because you only met your sister this summer, is
that right? That's right. I only met her about 2 weeks before I made the Dáil speech. So earlier in July, I met her. And what had happened was that my birth mother, I was adopted inter family, so my aunt became my mother. And my birth mother had been married, had had three children, and her husband went to England and never came back. He got work there, but he never came back. And she met somebody after that and became pregnant on me. This was small, rural village Ireland where she was denounced from the pulpit, and absolutely shamed. Her children were, you know, derided on the street. It was a terrible place to be. But what I didn't realise then, until earlier this year, was 5 years after I was born, and I was very, very lucky to be adopted into the family, she became pregnant again and had another baby. And I never knew this. So my younger sister, she was adopted by a family who then emigrated to the UK. And when her adoptive parents died, she started to trace where she came from. She didn't want to do that up until then. And so I got an email out of the blue earlier in the year to say, I hope it's not an intrusion, but I think I might be your sister. And so she'd heard from a mutual cousin of ours about me. So she made contact. So she came over then, just end of June, early July, to travel around and to try and find her roots. And we arranged to meet over in the Merion Hotel, as I keep saying, giving them a plug, and which wouldn't be very usual for me to be going over to the Merion Hotel. But and it was just amazing to see her. I knew
you looked like each other, don't
you? Absolutely. As soon as I walked in, I knew it was her. Of all the people sitting around having coffee and tea and stuff like that. But completely different. We were absolute strangers. And this is why I'm trying to push this new legislation on information and tracing. That if for people, perhaps, you know, if people have a little bit of information, a surname or a part of the country, they can go into the general records office and go, you know, spend hours going through, and they will probably find some information. But it shouldn't be that hard. I think every single person is entitled to their birth cert when they're 18. And I think that, you know, there was
a... And you also, because you also put a child up for adoption.
I did. I became pregnant as a stupid teenager when I was 16. And a decision was made by my parents that I would be, this is when she was born, that I would have been too immature and to raise her. And so it wasn't my decision. I didn't realise at the time that was going to happen until the day that she was taken from me. When I was moving out to Bray then, I left the address of where we were moving to in the adoption agency. And some years later, she came looking for me. So we were reunited, which it's a lovely story. But as I say, people shouldn't, I mean, it is so difficult. There are thousands of people out there, either birth mothers or children mm-hmm. who are now adults, trying to find each other. We all know about the Philomena Lee story, which is an absolute tragedy. They were trying to find each other and didn't until her, you know, she found out her son had died.
You could have made a movie about your own story. I just thought it was phenomenal, Alison, that you know, because normally politicians are making speeches about issues, but this was somebody talking from the heart and talking with the kind of experience you've just described.
Even to hear and give more detail on it there again, it's quite amazing. And the notion of seeing it from every angle, and you tell the story with such dignity. I mean, there's no, and the details that she's giving about this bill, I mean, I don't see how anybody could argue against it, how you could say that this shouldn't happen and that everybody should see their own birth certificate. Mm-hmm. You can't. So I would really hope that will be pushed forward. And one final tiny point, I think that it shows that sort of a speech, and I think giving that sort of a personal insight is something that you get from having more female politicians, if I may say that, and that's the sort of richness and colour that could be brought to our parliament.
And you've some good news as well, don't you, Anne?
Yes, I'm getting married on Friday week. Looking forward to that. And I think it's about 10 days after that, I'll be turning 60. So it's all happening this year for me. Wow. Yes.
That's one fantastic summer, isn't it?
It is. It's a definite it is movie indeed. In there.
Well, I'm available.
All we can say to that is congratulations and the very best of luck with the bill and with the marriage and with everything else.
The future looks good.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you for joining us. What we're going to do is take a break now before the news headlines at midday from Susan Jackson.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.